Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, focused on making holiday hosting effortless with party trays, cookies, and holiday favorites. Harmon's for the holidays.
The journalist Bridget Reed has a new book about multi-level marketing. You know, Mary Kay Cosmetics or Herbalife or Amway. There are a lot of these companies, for example, in Utah. Her book is called Little Bosses Everywhere, and the title gets the main draw for people who get into these MLMs. It's the independence and the freedom to set your own hours and set your own goals. The book is a history of the industry, but it's also a kind of expose on its empty promises and hollow claims. What Reed is really interested in is the plan, that is, the premise, the framework the early MLM founders came up with. It's this idea that the real money doesn't actually come from selling makeup or soap. The real money comes from getting someone under you to do that. And at the heart of the book are the people who get swept up in this system. Reed says the vast majority of people who join these MLMs, especially those at the bottom, make very little or no commission because the system is designed to pay out at the top. At the heart of this history are real people who get caught up in the system. And Reed follows a woman she calls Monique, an Air Force veteran in South Florida struggling to adjust to civilian life and find work.
When she joined Mary Kay in 2013, she was out of the military, living on a fixed income, and she still can't really make ends meet. So she joins a business networking club kind of thing. And she meets some people, and one of them is a Mary Kay independent beauty consultant. And she doesn't really know what that means. But this woman kind of chases her down to give her a facial, which ends up being a pitch for Mary Kay products because Mary Kay consultants are not trained facialists. They are saleswomen selling makeup, ostensibly. So after getting this facial, this woman invites her to an event at the local Mary Kay studio, which is a place where these Mary Kay beauty consultants gather. And this party is sort of the first time, I think, since leaving the military, she really finds people who make her feel wanted, feel loved, feel excited about life. A lot of the women at the studio are other consultants, and they're hanging out and listening to music and talking about this incredible opportunity, which is not just putting on this makeup, but the Mary Kay business opportunity to be a saleswoman. And some of the women there have seemingly climbed up the ladder in such a way where they're making money. You know, she hears about women who've gone on these trips and they're buying jewelry and nice clothes, and she could do it too, is what they're telling her. And crucially, they also feed her. You know, at this point, Monique really doesn't have a lot of money. So she's kind of living off of, you know, fast food and peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. And there's just a lot of pizza around this party. So that's actually something that, you know, I think really influenced her. She was hungry. And so at the end of this night, she decides to join Mary Kay and become a beauty consultant. And it costs around $200. Which she puts on a credit card because she doesn't have really $200. And that's sort of the beginning of her journey. Monique, you know, she doesn't really have a high level of education or skills training that would get her access to a higher paying job. She is used to an incredibly regimented world in the military, and has kind of been feeling like she really would like to have more flexibility, be in charge of herself, and have a little more freedom. I mean, that's really the word, right? Which is, of course, a word that really resonates, I think, for all kinds of Americans. So certainly, you know, the idea that Mary Kay, not only are you sort of availing yourself of this incredible business model, which the consultants tell you over and over has made many women millionaires, but, you know, conversely, you are in charge of yourself. You actually are an independent contractor. You're a 1099 worker. You are, in effect, a small business owner, is how they put it. And that has long been the pitch since multi-level marketing was conceived. independent contractors are the army that make up this distribution channel or business model, however you want to call it. At this point in my research, I knew a lot about multi-level marketing, but not really from within. And I really wanted to talk to somebody who was much closer to being involved in the company and in multi-level marketing in general, so that I could granularly understand what it means to be enrolled in this company and how it actually works. So talking to Monique was great because she kind of has a journey within Mary Kay. And at the time, she was still very much enrolled, very much active. And so really trying to understand from a journalist perspective exactly what it's like to be in this company and not kind of come only with perhaps some more biased opinions on what it looks like. You know, I have a full-time job. I'm a worker, right? I know what that means for me. And I wanted to know what it meant for her to be a 1099 employee in this company.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Bridget Reed is with us today. Her book is called Little Bosses Everywhere. The book started out as a magazine article. This happens to a lot of writers. And in Reed's case, she was exploring the effect of the pandemic on women who had been laid off or were juggling caregiving at that really strange time, women who figured they'd give Mary Kay or Amway a shot.
Multiple marketing companies during this time had a very well-documented kind of bump because so many women were stuck at home and looking for that flexible work, you know, something that they could do kind of with a kid sitting on their knee or while they're like watching their kid at Zoom school. And I and many other journalists wrote articles about this. You know, when you're a reporter, you're looking at something maybe contemporary and you think, okay, what is this? And so then you go to the actual institution, the organization, the business, whatever it is, the industry, and you kind of try to set up the background, right? And multi-level marketing just had a background that was like uncanny to me. I had never encountered anything like it in terms of it being characterized as a scam, but also being very much a legal type of American business, but one that is extremely predatory and has been, you know, many of the companies that use the business model are accused of being pyramid schemes and successfully shut down. And yet the people who had made money in this way were, you know, very legitimate and very wealthy people who had backed some of the most powerful people in this country. Mm-hmm. And they were all over the world. And so, like, all of those contradictions were, you know, they stuck with me after I wrote this article. And so I really just became sort of obsessed with figuring out what the heck this thing is. And it had to do with gender politics, also about labor and class, and then really like the American dream, questions about who is able to access it, inequality. Like, these are really the big questions that are powering all kinds of conversations. And so MLM and the history of multi-level marketing just really had all of that in one topic.
I want to ask you about Robert Fitzpatrick, because he seems like he was really influential in the way you were thinking about all of this. How important was he for getting the story right for you?
If Robert hadn't done the work that he did, I and many other people, I think, certainly would not be able at all to tell the stories that we've told about multi-level marketing. Robert is really the first person who wasn't a regulator, you know, already kind of working on task forces about pyramid schemes, but a layperson who looked at this stuff and said, wait, this is all the same thing. You know, he was involved in what eventually became a pyramid scheme that he was brought into as what was called a kind of gifting club, which is a type of Ponzi scheme in the 80s in Florida. And it kind of really took over his world and left a lot of devastation in its wake. And he never really shook that. And then when he started seeing multi-level marketing companies that purported to be something different than that scheme, Amway, there was one called National Safety Associates, which isn't around anymore. New Skin was big for him in the 90s. He started hearing about the way they worked and a light bulb went off. And he has been the dedicated skeptic of multi-level marketing for years and years when there wasn't a groundswell. He's been part of every time, you know, people who other critics of this industry have come together. But he's also among, you know, probably the first person to dig even further back into the origins of this industry and figure out, like, who are these men that invented this and what were they doing and why is this legal? Why is it something we all kind of shrug about? And so he really is like almost a, I call him the original Cassandra of multi-level marketing because he's been asking the questions the longest. He's been so persistent and he really has in every moment, you know, kept bringing awareness to this phenomenon. Again, in the times when no one was around. And so that dedication, I mean, I really couldn't have written this book without him.
One of the things he says, and you quote him in the book, is that it was a, he said, a metaphysical view of life in which there is no scarcity and that it required a certain faith and belief. Do you think some of those are some of the ideas that he's pinpointing here early on that help explain the appeal for some?
Totally. But also I think it really just illustrates the sort of rapture kind of vibe. You know, the idea that you are going to reap God's abundance and rewards through selling something like makeup or like water purification devices or toothpaste or whatever, you know, vitamins, all of these different companies that were hawking kind of products. I mean, think about if you're a man, he was in his 40s at the time in the 80s, right? This stuff has been around for a long time in the United States. People have been selling products for a long time. And now in the 80s, we are in the era of Walmart almost. We're in the big box store. We're certainly in the era of the grocery store and retail culture, right? We are no longer in a place where one needs to go to a door-to-door salesman to get anything.
Yeah,
I mean, it's just the idea that doing that is going to change your entire life. You do have to have a blind faith of some kind or a sort of conversion moment almost to arrive at that conclusion and to go with somebody that comes to you with that pitch. You know, it really does involve a suspension of disbelief and a kind of faith because it makes no sense to the critical thinking mind. And it really does, I think, tap into the deepest desires and anxieties of folks who see no other way and who so desperately want to believe that something as simple as selling makeup door to door could change their entire lives and those lives of their families.
Mm. One of the things I wanted to sort of get your sense of, like, the language that you use, because there's this question that's obviously going to come up, and I'm sure you're hearing it, of whether or not what you're writing about and talking about is that there are just some bad apples among some companies that do have legitimate practices and good intentions. But it seems like what you're saying is that the structure itself of multi-level marketing is just unethical.
Yeah. The bad apples, a good apples narrative is what the industry has enjoyed protection from for years, since 1979, when the FTC allowed Amway to carry on with its business model. Despite the so-called Amway rules, they amounted to the idea that you could have rules in place that would keep a business powered by recruitment, like MLM is, from being a pyramid scheme. And what the project of the book was in answering that question. And I truly believe the evidence shows that multi-level marketing was conceived in the exact same way that we think of a pyramid scheme. The men who invented the first multi-level marketing company, it was called Nutrilite, it became Amway. They were very open that this was a business structured by purchases by distributors, right? That people are in the system are being rewarded by the amount of product that they buy and the amount of people they bring in behind them. And of course, the way that we define a pyramid scheme today through American case law, the precedent the FTC has set is exactly that. A business in which retail sales are not the basis of rewards in the system. Mm. Recruitment is the basis of rewards. That was always the business model. That is openly the business model through the 60s and 70s. Of many companies that exist today. And when the government tried to crack down, the industry itself via Amway sort of set up these rules that have never been enforced. The FTC didn't crack open their books to show that they exist and were actually being enforced in the company. There's masses of evidence that they've never been enforced since. Every time the FTC does get that kind of access to a company, for example, when the FTC sued Herbalife in 2016, we find ample evidence that the rewards are exactly as they used to be for recruiting, that it creates a tiny fraction of success at the top, relies on relentless loss at the bottom, and that has never changed.
It's Bridget Reed. She's a features writer at New York Magazine. Her new book is called Little Bosses Everywhere: How the Pyramid Scheme Shaped America. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, focused on making holiday hosting effortless with party trays, cookies, and holiday favorites. Harmon's for the holidays.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with the journalist Bridget Reed about the history of multi-level marketing. Companies like Amway and Mary Kay and Herbalife, which promise independence, but in her new book, Reed says MLM is one of the most damaging scams in modern history. She says most of the people who sign up with these companies, especially those at the bottom, make little or no commission because it's a system that's designed to pay out at the top. And if it sounds like a pyramid scheme, she says it is. Her book is called Little Bosses Everywhere. Before we get to what it actually is, what's the story that they tell of direct selling? That it has this sort of, as you say, homespun Yankee ingenuity. It has these historical roots. Like, what's the story they tell before we get to the story you found?
There's a few different versions of this. And, you know, by now, multi-level marketing has a lobbying organization called the Direct Selling Association. Yeah. They have an academic group of college professors around the country who are paid by the lobbying group to research and produce paperwork, academic work on, quote, direct selling, which is how the industry refers to itself now since multi-level marketing, which was itself nomenclature that was put in place to avoid being called a pyramid scheme. Now multi-level marketing has a bit of a bad taste. And so now we're back to direct selling. But the version of this that's sort of the industry tale is that door-to-door selling is like a classic American pastime. And that's, you know, in the 40s, some salesmen who were disaffected with the traditional model invented an ingenious compensation model, which was known as the plan.
Right.
And they brought it to a sort of ingenious, maverick, homemade vitamin maker named Carl Renborg. This is in Southern California. And through that company, Nutrilite, they kind of revolutionized the direct selling industry through this business model that they truly believe or portray it as sort of as ingenious as, you know, the advent of the internet. Like, it's almost a technology that they've applied. And the simplest way to think about it is, in the way that they say it, salesmen, instead of reaching a certain point where they have to sort of, they can't grow their business as much as they can, right? Traditional door-to-door salesmen are always, like, giving someone else a cut.
Yeah.
Difference is, these guys said, okay, if you're a salesman and you join and you bring in a salesperson under you, you're going to get a cut from them, but you're also going to get a cut from the people they bring in and the people they bring in and on and on and on. Now, what they did not say was that you're not getting a cut of what that person sells. You're getting a cut of what they buy. You are getting rewarded by the company based on bringing more people in who are buying more products, and they're bringing people in who are buying products. So no one in this system is being rewarded based on actual sales, which, of course, if you were in direct selling, you would know that's the worst part of door-to-door sales. That's the kind of quick and dirty version of how it started. So it's just this natural evolution of door-to-door selling in the industry's telling. But what they leave out is that what these guys really invented was what they called purchase volume. So yeah, in this system, the salesmen were rewarded on purchase volume. Then they just translated that into retail sales. So they were buying wholesale vitamins. They would just take that amount of wholesale vitamins and call it retail sales. So within 10 years, you know, this company, this which was failing because the vitamin maker was totally just a failed salesman himself.
Yeah.
Not a doctor, not a scientist, posed as a doctor and a scientist,
right,
making these homemade alfalfa pills. But, you know, they took this company from basically failing to a multimillion dollar company. And they're saying it's with, you know, several tens of millions of retail sales. In fact, all they're keeping track of is sales in wholesale vitamins to an ever-growing pool of salespeople.
So the sales idea, the word sales doesn't mean what it usually means. You describe it as this impressive feat of doublespeak. So the so-called sales numbers that we see aren't measuring the number of tubes of toothpaste or hand cream purchased by people who would, you know, brush their teeth or moisturize their hands. It's the number of the sales force who are buying the toothpaste and hand cream. That's the sales.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. So what does industry know? Do they know how many people – I mean, they obviously know how many people are enrolled in these programs. I mean, one of the things you write is that anything they say about what happens after – including whether the products that these people are buying are actually being resold, that you say essentially are made up.
Mm. So yeah, that's what I mean, is that what they do, it is a known, it's not even an open secret. It's just known within the multi-level marketing industry at large, but also within multi-level marketing companies, that all they keep track of are sales to their own participants. And that retail sales are these incredibly hypothetical figures because so much of it is untracked. Also, a lot of it is frankly, it is made up because participants are fudging their own numbers constantly to meet requirements. Also to, for example, one of those Amway rules I referenced, that you're supposed to have 10 customers a month. I've spoken to many former Amway recruits who said how easy it was to fake those 10 customers. So even the little retail sales tracking that does go on is full, I believe, of alterations.
So Monique, when she was doing this, she had to buy the starter kit. And then she had to basically fill up her living room with product. But to move up didn't mean you sell that stuff that's in your living room. It means you add new team members downline. Downline is the sort of the term. But you also mentioned that when you're writing about the history, you also mentioned that direct selling firms in the old guard, back in the day, they didn't require salespeople to buy their products up front. Like, it seemed like there was a moment when there was – before the plan – there might have been a kind of legitimate effort to do something like that. Is that right?
Oh, sure. Door-to-door selling was always kind of a crappy type of work.
Yeah.
And that has been documented by a bunch of great writers and academics. But even then, you know, direct selling, salesmen, door-to-door selling, we don't know as much about this industry as we do say agriculture or say mining or factory work, because this type of labor was already so degraded in terms of it being a last resort. You know, these door-to-door salesmen were independent contractors in the sense that they were, you know, before we even really had that as a category of work, which happened in the 30s in the New Deal. When all these labor protections that we now know as status quo, but when they were created, you know, having full-time employees, having a payroll tax, having social security benefits, you know, independent contractors were solidified as a labor category so that employers would not be burdened by having these as full-time workers, right? It was a category of labor where employers were not responsible in the same way for those workers. But yes, you're right. From what we do know about Fuller Brush and then Avon, they had their distributors take orders from their customers and then go get the product and then deliver the product, take the next round of orders. So there was always, you know, you were not really allowed to buy Fuller Brush products if you weren't a successful salesman. Like, they weren't going to give you more if you couldn't prove that you were selling them, which is the opposite of multi-level marketing, right? Because in multi-level marketing, you buy the products to sell. And you can re-up right away. You know, Monique bought $1,800 worth of Mary Kay products before she'd sold a single lipstick.
I love the part of the book where you mentioned how salesmen, mostly men in the time, were sort of thought of in literature. And like Arthur Miller, Death of a Salesman, you mentioned there's this great line where he thinks about his uncle, as Miller put it, as a kind of wonderful inventor, something in him that was terribly moving because his suffering was right on his skin. That section in the book I wanted you to talk about, where you talk about how there becomes a modern concept of sales. It became a psychology. It became an art. And then there were these sales techniques. You had marketing. It just seemed to evolve. And will you talk about that part of the book that you worked on?
I think what's important to understand about that is that by the time the plan is invented, the idea of being a salesman and that being a way of life that was almost patriotic, at the same time, not well-respected or protected work in the United States. And so that kind of dichotomy, contradiction, is at the heart of selling and salesmen. And so then it creates this kind of world, almost a secondary market of sales techniques, sales trainings, sales materials, because there's this idea that if you can figure out how to be a really good salesman, you can change your whole life. But at the same time, it's really, really difficult. And it's almost the odds of you making it are like gambling. You know, it's that difficult to make it. And so, you know, it creates this idea that selling can be taught, can be a science, you know, even though it's also something that seems to be, you have to kind of be preternaturally talented. Mm. And so you have these people like Dale Carnegie, who writes How to Win Friends and Influence People, which becomes a huge bestseller. Yeah. And these are times when salesology as a concept booms. They tend to be those uncertain economic times when there are people who are desperate and looking for quick work, and selling always offers itself as something that anybody can do. And so there is this idea that you can change your whole life if you're just able to sell something. So there's a lot of storytelling going on about the salesman, even as selling has never been something that delivers for lots of people, you know?
Yeah. You write about something you say early on in the book, is that multi-level marketing is the engine that creates this culture of selling and being sold, and that it had this plan, kind of like a plot to, as you put it anyway, to reorganize everything about how we work and survive and take care of one another, basically to redefine that American dream. Say more about that, because this seems, I guess, to eventually get us anyway into that part of the story that you tell where MLM becomes an important part of the conservative movement to really push the idea of this, you know, crusade for the free market and for capitalism.
Yes. When you read those lines back to me, they sound so dramatic. But unfortunately, I think they're true. But the stakes, yeah, are quite high when you really track how MLM has shaped our current moment. But it does actually go all the way back to the guys who started the plan in 1945. Their names were Lee Mittinger and William Castleberry.
Yeah.
And then Carl Renborg is the vitamin inventor. Already, very early on, they were kind of in league with this group of, at the time, quite fringe right-wing or conservative thinkers. And they were members of a kind of loose federation. And some of them, like this guy Leonard Reed, who we might think of as like a father of maybe libertarianism now, but also, you know, the DuPonts, who were very much like a pro-capitalism. They were terrified of Social Security. That really always was a movement that was close to multi-level marketing. Leonard Reed, that person I spoke to who started a think tank called the Foundation for Economic Education, he was very much mobilized by the New Deal, that it really was a threat to like capitalism and the future of American capitalism. We had to undo these things, undo the New Deal status quo. And he spoke at the Nutrilite 10-year anniversary Then all of the founders associated themselves with Richard Nixon. So this is early on in the 50s and 60s. It's really then the Amway founders, Rich DeVos and Jay Van Andel, who take up that cause in the most robust, explicit, and quite calculated, openly calculated way. When they grow Amway in the 60s and 70s, they already funnel a lot of that money into right-wing causes. They have an ally in Gerald Ford, who's their Republican congressman from Michigan, where Grand Rapids, where they live, and where Amway is based. And then they really power through the 70s what we now think of as the new right. So DeVos and Van Andel are Calvinist Christians. They give a lot of money to evangelical and other conservative Christian groups. They give money to start the Heritage Foundation. They give, to countless Republican politicians, most importantly, Ronald Reagan, who they helped elect in 1980. And so they are really among the most important right-wing donors, thinkers, thought leaders, figures over the course of the 70s and 80s. And they're sort of fringe at the beginning. And then by the time Ronald Reagan is elected, they have actually become the power brokers in the Republican Party. And they can really start the project of undoing that New Deal consensus, pulling apart the welfare state, deregulating all kinds of things that were heavily regulated, financializing and privatizing all kinds of industries. Basically, the idea that capital was going to best serve Americans if it was as unfettered as possible, rather than the idea that there are regulations that help protect regular people from private businesses, from private profit.
Bridget Reed. Her book is called Little Bosses Everywhere: How the Pyramid Scheme Shaped America. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from listeners like you. Become a member at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the journalist Bridget Reed. We're talking about her new book, Little Bosses Everywhere. You don't tease out any particular place, state in the book, but I have to ask about Utah. This place is often called the sort of the unofficial capital of multi-level marketing. There's like, I don't know what the tally is these days, like 15 major headquarters like Young Living and New Skin and doTERRA. I think I saw once that it was thought of as possibly multi-level marketing was like the second largest industry after tourism in Utah. 91 MLM companies around, the Tribune reported this a couple of years ago. What do you make of that? I mean, clearly the questions that come up are, gosh, why Utah? And then the idea of, well, there's, you know, a lot of Mormons here. And so there's these community networks and there's this culture of stay-at-home mothers that could use a side hustle. And there's business-friendly regulation. What do you know about, or what do you think about Utah in this story?
Utah is sort of a later chapter in terms of MLM's founding history. From the research I was able to do, I believe the first Utah MLM was called Nature's Sunshine Products, and it was sort of spread after Nutrilite and after another company called Shackley, and started in the 1960s, if not late 50s. And then New Skin is really the MLM that kind of brings Utah into the modern MLM era. So New Skin being one of the first companies that was post that 1979 FTC decision. So once MLM is sort of effectively legalized and then unleashed on the world, which is really what happens. I mean, the number of MLMs just like explodes even more. New Skin is really the most important, I think, company to in Utah that then brings so much of the industry to that state. I think that absolutely, like Mormon culture, any kind of traditional religious culture where women are the domestic primary caregivers, I think, lends itself to multi-level marketing. It's not unique to Mormonism. I think a lot of religions kind of allow for that to happen at the same time. Utah, in the modern era, has unfortunately, I think, given a framework for state laws that are lenient. For example, I think Utah is a state where their definition of a pyramid scheme, you know, your rewards can't be from recruiting.
Yeah.
I think they're a state that, for example, has the word primarily in front of it. So your rewards can't primarily be from recruiting. You know, legal experts who have tried to regulate MLM, they have shown how even just that one word helps companies get out of being regulated or being called a pyramid scheme, because they can argue that there are, you know, other ways that folks are being compensated and kind of get out of it that way. And I know that that has happened through very conscious effort on the part of the industry to elect friendly politicians to give on the state level, on the local level. But then also, you know, people like Mitt Romney, who is, you know, of course, a very important figure to Utah. He is hugely friendly to the industry. You know, there have been, I believe, politicians from Utah who have been actively enrolled in MLMs.
One of the things you sort of you mention in the book is that it's MLM has kind of started to morph into these different variants. There are these different products, and then, you know, then there are different, you know, recruits have different motives, I suppose. And I wondered if one of the ideas that seems to be part of the culture is that you sort of turn against experts or big institutions, if that's part of the sort of idea, that you're going to see, or maybe you already are, seeing the MLM industry taking advantage of the ideas of the moment. Like RFK and the MAHA moment could, you know, they could sell a lot of vitamins, these ideas maybe. I don't know. Are you seeing anything like that?
Yeah, I think that there are ways that the promotion side of multi-level marketing, so the idea that you're sharing this business model and that the way you're recruiting people is through your lifestyle, you know, like Monique being drawn into Mary Kay because of all of the things these women said they were doing in their lives,
yeah.
You know, so not even just like a it's not like she was getting a P&L, right? And that's what made her join. It was that they were happy. They were being glamorous. You know, social media has made that 1,000% easier than it used to be. You know, Amway recruits used to do some crazy stuff like, you know, have people outside a country club that they weren't a member of just to make it look like, oh, I was just in this country club, you know, or like, they still do it today where they'll go take a picture next to a car that's not theirs or take a video in a fancy house. Now it's just so much easier to do that en masse and to spread through promotion. And so I think MLM has now like that promotion engine. You can find it in so many other businesses or other communities, let's say, because MAHA, for example, is a community that I think very much relies on promoting these ideas and influencing. And so MLM, I think, is like pretty much the first kind of influencer economy because people were, you know, Dexter Yeager, who's one of the most famous Amway downline kind of kingpins, I mean, just had this incredible influencer business, like basically sharing, you know, people would take buses from all over the country to come stand outside his mansion, you know. And so whether it's cryptocurrency or coaching, I think that that is like the MLM engine at work, even if the product-based, retailing isn't happening. Like, yes, I think I know actually that there are some prominent, you know, purveyors of MLM products who are also very vocally pro RFK Jr.'s, you know, agenda.
Yeah.
It's almost like they're both now selling that agenda as well as the products for sure. So, I think that they go hand in hand. And yeah, when it is so unregulated, so whether it's like raw milk or, you know, these various health fads that really go with deregulation, then, you know, that really is multi-level marketing's legacy because multi-level marketing has flourished in an area of totally unregulated lack of oversight for since the 70s. And so they made the model, and now all kinds of, quote, industries are cashing in.
There's this study that you mentioned. It's from a while back, but it was so startling, that said 99% of participants in MLM companies, or at least there were like 300 of these companies, 99% of them lost money. Which raises the question that you really do sort of work at in the book, which is, haven't people caught on yet? How does it still enroll fresh recruits every single day? Because it's hanging around. And you really get to that question when you go to Dallas to the Mary Kay conference, the convention there. This was a couple of years ago in the dead heat of Dallas summer. As you say, you forgot to pack your heels. would you talk about that experience? Explain why you wanted to go. You said after all the research that you had done, you felt like there was something that was missing from the story.
Yeah, I mean, on a bit more pedantic but important level, the thing to remember about multi-level marketing as an industry is that since the 1980s, the overwhelming majority of participants are overseas. So that's another reason that the industry, which looks like this robust industry with, like I said, a lobbying group, they're on K Street, the DeVos family, all this, but they, most people being enrolled in MLM every day are in India or China or Brazil. They're not in North America, certainly, and they're not in the United States. So that's really important, because those are places where they are in a transitioning economy. People are really desperate to get in on a sales model, and they're very much have a lower GDP than we do. And so this is a pitch that extremely they are vulnerable to. So that is a big part of why, when Americans say, well, how do people still join this? It's like, well, there are maybe several hundred thousand for each company, maybe, left for the big ones. Like Amway, the latest numbers they released that are in the book, it's a few hundred thousand people are still in Amway in North America. That's not very many, compared to our population. But the vast majority are overseas. So still, your question, how do those few hundred thousand people still join these companies, especially when there are so many other opportunities now to do this low-cost, quote, flexible work, like gig work, retail work, and basically, like, figure out something to do for 2 hours. Yeah. I and that is why I went to the convention, because I just wanted to really feel what it was like at the peak of the positivity in MLM, which I have learned as conventions. I mean, people really work and work and work all year to get to the convention, because that's where they're rewarded. In front of people, they're really given recognition. And Mary Kay said, she realized that women wanted recognition more than anything, even more than money, which is why she made Seminar, which is her name for convention, so important from the very first year that she was in business in 1963. So, yeah, I mean, I learned there that the catharsis that Mary Kay offers a lot, it wasn't exclusively women, but mostly women, it was a lot of women who were expressing suffering that they were going through. I mean, this is a primarily the women in this room, most of them are not rich, right? Because only a tiny fraction has made a living from this. Most women are not wealthy, well-off people. And so they bring with them all kinds of pain, whether it's medical debt or, sickness, family members are sick, they can't, they've had to leave work to take care of them, or they're in student debt, they have addictions, their family members have addictions. I mean, and you hear this because there really is this like confessional environment, like a church almost. And the way that Mary Kay, the company and the uplines and the business really sublimated all that energy and channeled it into like you can do better. You will be better. You know, you will, where you're, you can control all of that yourself, yeah. Right? You don't have to, we don't have to sign a petition or draft policy or all of the other ways you might think about improving. If you consider those to be structural issues, how you might tackle them as structural issues instead, you can actually take care of all of them yourself. Your reality is in your control. You don't have to feel bad. You don't have to feel sad. You don't even have to be sick. Mm. You can manifest your own future, your own prosperity, and your family's health and security. You can do all of that yourself just by working harder, listening to this speech, you know, being more in control of your life, you regimenting what you do with your time, praying, all of these things. I mean, it really, and everyone's doing it together. So even though it's this incredibly individualized process and the rhetoric is so individual, you're standing hand in hand with a whole stadium full of women who are doing it with you. So it really does create this communal environment at the same time that they're telling you you have to solve all your problems yourself, you know? So it was very moving.
Yeah. Did that surprise you to feel that way?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes. I really thought that I would be a much more cynical sort of remove, at a more cynical remove that is more familiar to me as a reporter. But I really felt convinced by, you know, it was a relief to think that I could fix myself. You know, it felt very soothing to think that all of the ills of the future, that we can take care of it ourselves, and that none of it relies on like mutual or structural revolution, you know, reorganization. That's so overwhelming. You know, it's much easier to say in my heart, I can work on myself, and I don't need to think about anybody else.
You say in the book that when you went through all of this, that you kind of felt like you had ended up, this is how you put it, inside the same deep burrow as Robert Fitzpatrick. We were talking about Robert Fitzpatrick earlier. Like you had, as you say, tunneled into the center of a conspiracy. Say something about that finally, about how you were left feeling at the end.
Yeah, and this is like actually the drum that Robert beats, which is that it's a conspiracy because they know they're doing it. And I think that that's really important for anybody wanting to talk about this issue. If you look at the whole history of MLM, as I tried to do, and I definitely don't think it's the whole history. I think I was able to you scratch the surface pretty much. There is so much evidence that the people in charge of these companies know what they're doing. They've been told by their own distributors who've left that they are being harmed. You know, the government has told them they're harming people and many, many times. You know, Amway, despite the 1978 decision, you know, the last time they settled a giant class action was, you know, less than 15 years ago. So, you know, they have, these are harms that are not unknown to the organizers of these companies. There's a reason Amway was compared to the mafia by the man who created the RICO Act, a law professor named G. Robert Blakey, who was hired by PG&E when they had litigation with Amway in the 90s. You know, these are, they don't want to talk about this, and they don't want a tide to shift on multi marketing. And I really believe that it can. I don't know if that's going to come from the law or Congress or the FTC. I really think it will come from just people being aware. You can read it for yourself. You can read lawsuits for yourself. You can read about the founding of these companies and the whole plan itself. You can read it. You know, you can read them in their own words. You don't have to be convinced by my arguments. You can just look at the evidence and tell the truth. And so, you know, that's really what how I feel is I feel that my job as a journalist is to lay out truths, to do fact finding and put the truth out there. And so I just hope people will come to this project with that. You know, don't think about being convinced of my argument or Robert Fitzpatrick's argument. And you don't have to end up where I did, but read the book, look at the evidence, and then, you know, we can talk about a different opinion if you have one. But I do think, you know, I want people to know that that's what I tried to do. I wasn't trying to argue something that I had already decided. I really went on a journey and ended up in a place because that's what I discovered, you know, to the best of my abilities in looking at what really happened.
Bridget Reed, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Bridget Reed, she's a features writer at New York Magazine. Her new book is called Little Bosses Everywhere, How the Pyramid Scheme Shaped America. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on YouTube at KUER90.1 and Instagram at Radio West, or you can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.